This is Colourful.
He is a Member of Parliament for York Central. He's chair of the all-party parliamentary group on Africa. He is Hugh Bailey, MP. Hugh, good morning and welcome to the programme. Without giving too much away, when would you say was your best year? The best 365 and a quarter days of your life?
Lots of good times, lots of bad times. I'm 60 years old now, so yep. You have good times and bad times. I loved it when I was a student and I was leaving home and free for the first time.
Free.
That was a great time.
Yep.
I loved being elected to Parliament when I was 40 years old. I loved being appointed to the government. I hated being sacked from the government shortly afterwards. You know, good times and bad times. But the thing is, you've got to be positive and you've got to work on things to make life as good as you can.
Mm. You've got lots of interests, of course, as one would expect, being an MP. But can you explain where the interest in Africa came from?
Oh, it's been there a long, long time. I had a godmother who lived in South Africa, and when I was a child, she'd write me letters about Africa. She'd send me storybooks with African stories. I remember I've still got a little, very small, but little carved wooden hippopotamus.
Oh, one of the big five, yeah?
And that was the one. Well, as a kid, it kind of meant something.
Yep.
And then I guess it would have been 1969, when there was a big campaign against the Springbok South African tour.
Yes.
To the UK. And I remember being given a leaflet at Notting Hill tube station.
It wasn't by Peter Hain, was it?
It was by a woman.
Yes.
I've been trying to work out who it was ever since. And I thought I'd better do something about this. So it had an address. I went round to the then anti-apartheid movement's office, which was in Charlotte Street in central London. I climbed these rickety stairs to a sort of clapped out old office, and I met this very sort of tough woman who, you know, I thought she'd be glad to see me. I said, I've got this leaflet, I want to help you, give me some leaflets, I'll get them out. And, you know, I was quizzed, interrogated for, you know, a good half hour for her to work out I wasn't a boss agent from South Africa trying to smash up the whole system. So I thought, well, that's a nice welcome. And I ended up for 20 years on the executive committee of the anti-apartheid movement, British-based solidarity movement with the liberation movements in Southern Africa, and it kind of got deep into my blood. Indeed, when I was first elected into Parliament,
yep,
I probably knew more politicians in South Africa than
wow,
I did in the UK.
So that's how it all started. And if I look at one particular website which concentrates in Africa, this is the latest news today. So EU forces attack Somalia pirates, and that's they're conducting their first raid on pirate bases on the Somali mainland. And then the International Criminal Court seeks Congo arrest warrants. We're talking, I don't think, about Joseph Kony, but there are a number of very serious people who have caused a lot of trouble in Central and Eastern Africa. There, ECOWAS threatens Mali's sanctions. That's the Economic Community of West African States. The reason why I'm reading those out is that usually on a day-by-day basis, the news emerging from Africa, as reported here in the West, is pretty bad. So do you consider it your mission to try and persuade people that actually Africa isn't, in quotes, the hopeless continent, as The Economist described it some years ago?
Yes, in a way. The news values like conflict and strife, and there's plenty of that in Africa, and mm-hmm, it's holding Africa back, and it's very serious. But you look at Africa over the last decade, it's got stronger growth than we've had in Europe.
Yep.
You've got some countries which are pretty well governed. You know, Ghana is, doing well. Tanzania is doing well. Nigeria still has huge problems of corruption.
Yeah.
But I remember going there 10 years ago and a couple of years ago, and it seemed to me in Lagos you had a thriving commercial centre with people in the private sector kind of shrugging off government and getting on with the business of creating wealth. And unless you create wealth, Africa will remain dependent upon donors and other countries, and Africa's proud of its own traditions, and by getting control of its own economy, by creating wealth itself, by mm-hmm, making politicians more accountable, it'll create an independent future for you know, themselves. Africans will.
You just used an interesting phrase, which I don't kind of associate with Labour politicians, which is that you talked about entrepreneurs shrugging off government. Is that what you think is necessary? Are government constricting countries in Africa?
I would say the biggest single thing that's held back Africa's development is poor governance. There's a strong tradition of a kind of big man in politics, a president. Very often you get presidents who want to extend their term when their term limit is over. Political parties are very often support mechanisms for the man at the top. There's very strong patronage. You don't get the tradition of members of parliament being elected to represent their communities and hold the government to account. You can look in Britain, people will say it's pretty flawed in some ways, but at least there's that tradition when a minister steps out of line, MPs are on their back. So
especially with the robust select committee system, yeah?
Well, that helps too. Yeah, I sit on the International Development Select Committee and we've pushed through quite a number of changes in policy. We persuaded the then Labour government to ramp up its aid programmes on HIV and AIDS. We persuaded them to close down their aid programme in China on the basis that, you know, China's wealthy enough to fund its own development. So the committees can push the government to do things that they wouldn't otherwise.
But just going back to that point, Hugh, how do you, I mean, we had, you know, there wasn't a tradition of, you know, it's been a tradition of having big men everywhere, you know, for the French Revolution and wherever you like, you know, I mean, where, how do you inculcate these values, if you like, of democracy? Isn't that an essential problem that we, that, if you like, the West, you know, has got? How you know, if we believe in this, that that's what matters, how do you inculcate them in Africa or anywhere else?
Well, it has to come from below. If I were to sort of go to Africa and say, here's a dollop of democracy, you know, spread that on your slice of bread and everything will be fine, it would feel alien and distant. It would feel like interference from outside and it wouldn't, you know, stir the people. It's got to come from African politicians. You think of, I mean, perhaps a very good example would be Wangari Maathai, who is an environmentalist from Kenya, who
is now the late Wangari Maathai, of course. Passed away, yeah.
Who won the Nobel Peace Prize. I remember making a film in Kenya 25, almost 30 years ago, where she was starting out trying to motivate women to grow saplings, plant trees, to provide a sustainable source of firewood. She empowered people. She said, you can do things for yourself and then you can put demands on those in power, those responsibility to get access to water, to make the system work. And it's got to come from below. The things that outsiders can do, quite a lot of Western democracies have democracy-building institutes, but they can only support what's going on in the country. You can't graft on a different politics.
And people need to remember as well that, you know, countries, as you say, they have their own traditions, because a lot of Africans get very, very upset when it's implied from outside the continent that there is no tradition of democracy or institutions on the continent, because of course people have been governed, people governing themselves for thousands of years before any contact with outsiders, European contact, etc. What's interesting about you, Hugh, and your all-party a group of MPs is that you have been looking and questioning the government on the choice of countries that receive UK aid. And of course you said, look, why are we giving China aid? And then what about the Indians? Because the Indians said last year, stop giving us aid. We don't need your aid unless you just want to sell us defence weapons and mechanisms. Can you explain why you're very concerned about this?
Well, I have to say I was there first. I was saying
you were ahead of the curve.
Pull the plug
on
India's aid, but that we should set a timetable, maybe 5 years, and say we're going to scale it back. And then in future, if India wants things that UK provides in aid, then it should buy them. I mean, it's got the resources. In terms of Africa, the new government, the Cameron government, when it came in, did a thorough review of all the bilateral programs. That's country-to-country programs that UK supports. And it decided to reduce the number from about 40 to about 25. I think that probably was a good idea. If you're on the receiving end, if you're a health minister receiving aid money, And you have 25 different countries each dipping in with £1 million of time. You spend all your time in meetings with your donors and none of your time managing your health service. So there have been a number of big international conferences in Paris, in Accra, recently in Busan, in Korea, which have set out terms to make aid more effective. Mm-hmm. And one of the terms says, concentrate your resources, do bigger programs in smaller countries so you spend less on bureaucracy and the diplomatic niceties and more money gets through to the people. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, there's been a thinning down of a number of countries in Africa, which are aided by the UK. Generally speaking, I think the approach makes sense. Some of the countries have decided to pull aid from. I think they've made the wrong call.
Right, okay. Well, I wonder which countries you think are now being denied aid wrongly.
In my view, top of the list is Burundi.
Right.
Burundi is still in a troubled area. You talked about the cases from the Congo, people being referred to the International Criminal Court. There have been, there's been violence and atrocities in Burundi, in Rwanda, in the DRC, in parts of Uganda as well. That Great Lakes region of Africa has a background of instability and violence. But generally, the Uganda economy is strong. The Kenyan economy has historically been strong. It had the blip after the last elections of very serious post-election violence. But it is a strong economy in Africa terms. Tanzania is moving ahead. All those countries are aided by the UK. So is Rwanda. So is the Democratic Republic of Congo. Big sums of money, £100 million a country, in some cases more. And Burundi, the poorest of all those countries, whose economy is closely tied to the others. They trade through them. They're landlocked, so all their trade has to go either through Tanzania or through Rwanda and Uganda and Kenya to the coast. To leave them out of the equation seems to me to be wrong, and I think the government should have said we're going to increase the aid program in Burundi. So it's a big program, mm-hmm. which the current, you know, good aid terms say you ought to have big programs, and they've moved in the wrong direction.
Right. I mean, there is something called the government needs effectiveness index, bit of jargon that most people won't understand, but it's basically how you rank a country according to its need. And people here in Britain are on the whole quite fair-minded. When we see need, obviously broadcast on television, we put our hands into our pockets and we say we're going to do something about this, right? But at the same time, we get very upset if we think this isn't working. The aid is going to countries where there's a dictator and it's just spending it on aircraft or, you know, lavish palaces and whatever. It's very, very difficult to try and separate all those things out. How do you know that a country really needs the money and that the money is being used properly to help the people who need it most?
Well, I think that's the key question. Remember, all this money comes from people in the UK, African people, of course, as well as British people in the UK who pay taxes. And you put it very well. If the money goes on immunizing small children so they don't get infectious diseases and die, they think that's possibly worthwhile. If it goes on buying a Mercedes for the health minister, they think that's a bad idea. So there are some terms which donors ought to apply to the aid, especially if they're giving it direct government to government, which I think is the best way to give aid, because that empowers Africans and African leaders, rather than saying, we'll buy a school for you, or we'll buy some textbooks for you, to say, let's fund the education program, but you run it. But you need to make sure, through what you might call a political audit, that the quality of governance means that the money will get through.
And even if the government thinks you're interfering and you're imposing conditionalities on us, because I keep hearing this word, conditionalities.
One of the things I say to African politicians who complain about the strings attached, we say to World Bank loans, is, look, your country has to decide whether to accept a loan. You ought to be, this is this question of accountability of leaders again, you ought to be requiring your government, your president, to come to the parliament and present a proposal to accept, $500 million from the World Bank for a particular purpose. The parliament should look at the strings. If they think the strings are unacceptable, turn it down. Say, go and renegotiate. It's up to Africans to determine whether the package, the money and the conditions, is a package which will be good for their country in which case accept it, bad for their country, in which case reject it, or try and argue for changes to the conditions to make it something that will work for the people.
So you encourage them to hold the elected, the chiefs, if you like, the you know, to their feet to the fire. You encourage them to do that.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you then, can I ask you, these conferences you referred to just now, did you go to them?
No.
Do you ever go to them?
Yeah, sometimes you get MPs who go, although I have to say, it's very often a sideshow. Let me try. I know where you're coming from. So the World Bank is a huge multinational institution funded by government. How can MPs have any leverage over it? I've set up something called the Parliamentary Network and the World Bank. We do the same with the International Monetary Fund, which over a 10-year period has sought to hold the bank and its policies to account, so that now the President of the World Bank, the head of the World Bank, will come once a year to our meetings. We'll answer questions a bit like a Prime Minister's question time. We've got them to send out good practice notes to their country offices. The World Bank will have an office in each country it aids to say that they ought to meet with the Parliament. They ought to send reports of what they're doing to the Parliament. It's moving slowly. You know, I would not say at all that the World Bank board says, hang on, we can't pass this policy. We better consult this little ginger group of parliamentarians.
Let's consult Hugh Bailey.
afraid not. But it has meant they're moving, and they're moving in the right direction. And what we also try and do through this network, it's about 2,000 parliamentarians, half from developing countries, half from donor countries, and we're trying to get the parliamentarians asking questions in their own parliaments to exercise leverage over their finance minister, shall we say, in charge of a budget, about how they deal with the World Bank. So it's a step-by-step process. It's often frustrating in Westminster. You know, I put demands to the government. I recently introduced a bill to guarantee an NHS right to treatment in the UK. It'll take quite some years before I get the government to give in and say, well, it's a good idea. People ought to come first. But, you know, you campaign for it, and sometimes you get the concessions.
And just wanted to ask you, I know you made it clear that you feel that, you know, Africans themselves should look at the conditions each time and then make the decision for themselves whether it's good for them and their country and whatnot. But what I was wondering is, when countries in the West, like Britain, get involved to the extent that they put their values, if you like, onto countries, some people might call it human rights, whatever. But for instance, recently with Cameron talking about gay rights in Uganda, what do you feel, what's your feeling personally and that of the Select Committee in areas like that? Do you encourage, would you encourage David Cameron to get more involved on those kind of issues? Or do you think that should be kept completely separate and out of the equation?
I think human rights are important. I don't think you can shrug them off. It's a universal declaration of human rights at the United Nations, which every country is signed up to. Does it mean anything? If it means something, let's get serious about it. And the conditions which some people suffer in prison, whether they're guilty or not in Africa, the brutalization of women, particularly in conflict areas, these are serious matters. And if Britain didn't do something about it, people in this country, I think, would have a right to complain. So these values matter. But once again, it's up to Africans. If they don't want to do business with somebody who is saying, and part of our program is to give more women the opportunity to get through school, then they can reject the aid, you know. Right.
But then what about the ordinary person who's at the bottom of the pile in that country, who then, you know, is the person most likely to suffer? How do you balance that?
Well, you have to sometimes compromise, but perhaps a good example would be after the elections, in fact, the elections before last in Ethiopia, where you have a strong government that's improved the welfare of people pretty well, but has become less and less tolerant of opposition parties, and a lot of opposition MPs, newly elected, were chucked into prison straight away afterwards. Then the UK ended its aid to the government of Ethiopia, but kept the money flowing through other sources, such as UN agencies, to the people you describe at the bottom of a pile. We've had a similar dispute, if you like, with the government of Malawi, which I hope will be resolved after the, you know, sad of the existing president, who was, you know, in dispute with the UK over some of the
Mutharika conditions. He died, and the new president
over some of the conditions that basically it was as a result of WikiLeaks. You know, WikiLeaks leaked one of the cables from our ambassador, our high commissioner to Malawi, criticizing the president's economic policies. The president didn't like that and expelled the ambassador, and things kind of spiraled out of control. I hope that's soon put right. But it is for Africans to determine their own destiny. And if they object to women's rights and don't want aid in those terms, then reject it.
All right. I got an email in from Justin responding, Hugh, to what you said about poor governance being Africa's number one problem. He says, poor governance? Yes, it is a problem, but the single biggest problem? What about Western trade policies? Dumping cheap grain and second-hand clothes? They've destroyed internal production and introduced dependency. What about the corrupt IMF deals to autocrats, which brought structural adjustment programs, which now the Greeks are realizing don't help anyone? The extraction of resources controlled by small elites have been encouraged by corporations that have wanted quick and relatively cheap access to raw materials. You hinted at that earlier. This has been aided by Western governments. Belgium's influence on the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, is a case in point. It has been Western rapacious trade policies which has subjugated African development. That's from Justin.
Well, what I would say to him is governance matters. If you want to do something about that, somebody in Africa has got to say no. Why aren't the presidents in Africa saying no to palpably bad trade policies? If you improve governance, if you strengthen the capacity of Africa to determine its own destiny, you've got a chance to say, we're not selling you.
So it begins and ends with governance.
Look, nobody from outside is going to put the best interests of Africa at heart. Africans have to do that. That's why governance is absolutely central. And it's why, you know, some countries in East Asia, say, you know, at the time of, the independence swept through the former British Empire in the late 50s and early 60s, Malaysia had broadly the same living standard as Ghana.
Ghana, yeah. So is Malaysia and Ghana.
As Zambia, you know. And now it's way ahead. It's got a kind of Western standard of living, higher than many members of the European Union. The government in Malaysia has been better controlled through the electorate.
But it had a dictator for a long time, Mahathir Mohamad, did it not? A very long time.
Well, it had an accountability to the people. It didn't have a Western-style democracy, you're right, but it had an accountability. And this is the word I use, not democracy, which has all sorts of values, going back to ancient Greece, loaded onto it. But it's accountability. Can a big man in Africa, and they're almost always men, of course, we're now going to change in Malawi.
Yeah,
change
Joyce Banda. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, those are the two exceptions, if you like, approve rule. It's normally a big man. Can he do what he thinks is best, or does he have to go with consent from the people as exercised by the parliament, by the media, by NGOs, civil society? Right. Is there some accountability?
I was thinking, you know, I was astonished how much in agreement I was with what you were saying most of the time, because... But anyway, but until you've gone on to the business of not actually defending democracy in the way that I think you should, I don't think you should ever apologise for it. I'm with Churchill, least worst form of government. But moving on, I think your answer to Juju was, the people, you know, yes, people are, unfortunately are going to get damaged at the bottom, but if they vote in the wrong governments, that's the price they pay, and that's the only way that, you know, these things can work in the end. Now, I want to move this on, because just onto the subject of Greece, we're in a situation here now where we're clearly either thing, you know, at the very best, things are very bad, and at the worst, we could be on the edge of a precipice, because basically the Greeks have voted, you know, have chosen, you know, trying to have their cake and eat it, and they can't. Essentially, that seems to be what's going to happen. But how do you, if we, as things are, how can you defend when we are possibly in so much trouble, which might get a lot worse? There's going to be a lot of pressure, you know, for us not to be spending all this aid to Africa very shortly, because they ring fence the international, you know, our aid program to Africa. How do you defend that?
The problem is already here. A lot of countries in Europe who, unlike our government, are cutting their aid budget, Italy, Spain. So the problem is already here. I think there'll be increasing pressure on our government to do the same. People will say, why cut funding for schools in Britain but not schools in Tanzania? I think to make the case for aid, you've got to show that the money gets through and immunizes children. and doesn't get wasted in bureaucracy in a system or international conferences that don't seem to achieve anything. And you have to show that it's in Britain's long-term interest, because it's cheaper to promote development than have foreign wars, for instance. You look at Afghanistan as a case in point. Some people would look at Libya.
Let me just stop there. That, for me, is the key point. Because I truly believe, I mean, Tony, we won't go into my personal philosophy, other than that I believe self-interest always rules. I don't really believe it's aid in the sense of us giving things away. There has to be a quid pro quo somewhere, otherwise we wouldn't be doing it. You know, it's about national self-interest. How do we make the case that it is for us? You know, because that's what people need to understand. If we send the money there, we are, you know, it's not just, you know, there is a value.
Well, we've just been talking about the security risks.
Yeah.
Parts of Africa become more lawless and Al-Qaeda groups become better entrenched, they could use some African countries as a base to operate, attacks in Europe from, rather like Afghanistan was used as a base to organise the 9/11 attacks in the United States. So with security issues, if countries develop, then they provide markets for British goods. You know, trade is not necessarily a bad thing, although as the caller, the emailer, said, the terms of trade are very important. But we get a lot of money from trade with India, shall we say, which is further up the development curve than many the countries in Africa. There are worries in this country about levels of immigration. Well, why do people come to Britain? They come to Britain for a better livelihood, by and large. Some, of course, fleeing persecution, but most are economic migrants. If they have a better future because there's development in their own countries and they can get a decent living in their own countries, there'll be less pressure to migrate. So the things that matter to us in Britain, which we can address through effective aid, not through ineffective aid, but through effective aid in African countries.
And that's Hugh, we're going to have to let you go very shortly, but we had a caller. Rajan is on the line, and he wants to ask you something about Africa. Rajan, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Morning.
Good morning.
I'm listening to it all, and it sounds very interesting, but on the other side, I've had the opportunity to meet with Michael Sata. I've been to Ethiopia, I met with Meles Zenawi, I met with Bingu Wa Mutharika and Joyce Banda, and a lot of the prime ministers and presidents in Africa. Isn't the real problem this? There are British companies operating in Africa right now, for example, Vedanta in Zambia. Their policies are absolutely terrible. And that's a technical word. It is really, really terrible what they're doing there. And it's really easy for us to stand here in the UK and point fingers saying you need to do X, Y, and Z. When A, their policies are their policies. Africa is generating its own income. Look at Angola, for example, the oil revenues there. If Africa was that bad, the likes of India and China would not be in the country. In the continent. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, you say X, Y, and Z should be done to control rapacious Western or British companies. Well, then do X, Y, and Z. That's what I would say. I'm a legislator. I can't legislate in Britain on workers' conditions in another country. My legislation only runs in Britain. So Africans have got to do that. And it's certainly true that some people in Africa are looking to the new investors like China, like Brazil, in Angola's case, like India, and saying, here, people who have less strings attached. But some of the things that the UK's got wrong through its aid and its commercial relations with Africa, for instance, building a road but training no one on how to maintain it so it falls apart in 5 years' time, I see some of the same mistakes being made by the new investors. So sometimes conditions like you've got to employ local labour when you're constructing a road so that people learn road building and road maintenance skills. Some of these conditions can actually be good conditions too.
All right, thank you.
But that has changed, though. The reality is that has changed. At my last meeting with Michael Sata, things have changed in Zambia, for example. If you look into terms of copper, everyone's moaning about the investment crisis in Zambia, but the reality is there is really no investment crisis. People are still coming over in herds.
Well, look,
isn't the fact this, though? Whatever you're propagating here is to the detriment of Africa. It's stopping investors coming over from the UK. And if the UK doesn't invest, somebody else will invest, and the UK is going to miss out on the next frontier of markets.
Okay, Hugh, just to finish off.
Well, I think we're actually pretty close to agreeing, because you say that Zambia is taking some of the steps, doing the things that it needs to do, and I would agree with that. It's a good thing.
All right.
We're
going to leave it there.
Let's keep
thank
on
you
doing good things.
Very
thank
much
you.
Indeed, because Hugh has to go. Rajan, thank you very much for calling us this morning on Colourful.
You're welcome. Okay, thank
Tremendous.
You.
Tremendous. And we've got an email from R Ara says, the comments by Justin were nonsense, and I'm glad that your guest stated that bad governance is a primary cause of African incompetence. The example of Ghana versus Malaysia should always be remembered whenever African development is being discussed. Thank you very much indeed to Hugh Bailey MP. We'll talk to you again.
You're listening to Colourful.